Firstly, I'd like to thank the organizers for giving me this chance to talk about my work. This work was done at Cavendish Lab. I'm on sabbatical there. I'm on leave from Sahai Institute of Nuclear Physics. I'll be comparing my present work that I did at Cavendish Lab with earlier work that I did at Sahai Institute. And for my earlier work, my collaborators were my students Sanjay Datta and Arnab Das. Arnab Das helped me with the numerical codes. And I had useful discussions with Littlewood, Simone Kors, who's a bright postdoc at Cavendish, and of course, Dimak Melnitsky, you all know.
Can you put this onto a whole screen? Or?
Yeah, sure. That's not okay. Or should I expand it further? View then?
Yeah.
Okay. Okay, good. Thanks. It always helps to have experts in the audience. Okay. So, I'll start off with a brief introduction. I mean, most of you already know the material of my introduction, but nevertheless, I thought I would sort of say a few words. Transitional metal oxides, which have one carrier in the EG orbitals, such as the manganese, the cuprates, or the nickelates, they undergo cooperative Yantella distortion, and this leads to interplay between charge spin and orbital degrees of freedom, and results in exotic phases. In the next slide, I'll show you the phase diagram for the manganates, which has one EG electron. The other point to note is that these EG electrons, they're coupling to the neighboring oxygen of the PD sigma type, and it produces at about 10% Yantella distortions, as seen by EXAPS measurements by people like Lanzara and so on. Also through pulse neutron diffraction, one can figure out the Yantella distortion, and indirect ways like resonant X-ray scattering also show sizable, they show orbital altering from which one can deduce Yantella distortions. Then the other point that I want to make is, which I think is quite important, that is, in systems like the manganates, you have an effective Hamiltonian for most of the interactions. Like, for example, for the spin interaction, you have the Anderson super exchange. Then if you take infinite Hund's coupling into account, then you have Degen's double exchange model. Then for the Coulombic interaction, you have either Goodswiller or dynamic mean field theory. But for the quantum cooperative Yantella interaction, at least to my knowledge, there's no good effective Hamiltonian, at least at the same level as these other effective Hamiltonians. And that, I think, is what is missing. And my work is a tiny step in that direction towards developing a effective Hamiltonian for cooperative Yantella interaction. Okay. So this is a phase diagram which I stole from, which is taken from Cheung's work. So as you can see, it's a complicated phase diagram. At zero doping, you have Yantella distorted LaMnO3 with Yantella distortion occurring at about 750 Kelvin. Above that, you have octahedral tilting, but no Yantella distortion. Below this, you have both octahedral tilting and Yantella distortion, and above that, it's just rhombohedral structure. Then, as you start doping, there are some interesting things that take place. One is that you have a ferromagnetic insulator and also a charge order insulator. I'm not sure that the charge ordering occurs before the some subtle points regarding this phase diagram are controversial. Okay, so whenever you have orbit, COI is charge orbit loaded insulator. Whenever you have orbit loadering, you expect that the Yantella interaction lifts the orbital degeneracy and prefers one orbit load to the other one, and that leads to orbit loadering. So we expect Yantella interaction, cooperative Yantella interaction, to play a role when you have orbit loadering. Then at higher doping, you have the ferromagnetic metal. And at higher dopings, you again have orbit loadering. So you can see that in systems like the manganates, one needs to understand how the orbit loadering occurs. And if one needs to understand how the orbit loadering occurs, one needs to have a reasonable model to understand cooperative Yantella effect. So this is the crystal structure. The black ones are the manganese. The manganese sits in octahedral environment of oxygens. Oxygens are 2-. So they produce a crystal field, and that lifts the degeneracy of the 3D orbitals. And there's another octahedron that surrounds this manganese ion. So these two manganese ions, they share a common oxygen, and that is what brings about the cooperative nature of the Yantella distortion. A distortion here will affect the occupation of this site, because if there's an electron here, that also will bring about its own distortion. So these two distortions need to be compatible. So that brings about the cooperative nature of these distortions and cooperative nature of orbit loadering. This one I took from Takashi Hota. It's not mine, but here you have the three different types of distortions that are possible for the EG electrons. This is the usual breathing mode that one knows, where all the oxygens either go out or go in. The Q2 distortion is where you have the oxygens move only in the plane. The diagonally opposite oxygens, they move in or out, and they are out of phase with each other, the two diagonals. And the Q3 distortion, where if in the plane you have oxygens moving in the out of plane ones, the oxygens move out, and vice versa. This sort of a distortion is produced when you have a dz square orbital sticking in this direction. On the other hand, if you have a dx square minus y square here, you have the oxygens going out, and the planar oxygens going out and the apical ones going in. So here you have the 3D degenerate orbital splitting, and between neighboring sites you have antiferromagnetic coupling. That's a super exchange, Anderson super exchange. And then when you want an electron to hop from this side to this side, you have Degen's double exchange coming. It's through this oxygen. And you have various types of Coulomb interaction between electrons in the same orbital, electrons of different orbitals, and these are exchanges between the orbitals and so on. And this is nearest neighbor interaction. In this particular system, you have, I don't need to go through details of crystal field and magnetic interaction, because my talk is mainly about cooperative interactions. Okay, so this is for the parent LMNO3. As you can see, the orbitals here are antiferromagnetically ordered in the plane, and two planes are coupled through, this orbital is the same as this orbital. To at least one way of looking at it is that, I sort of played around with this. For the in-plane orbit loadering, you can use Yantella interaction, cooperative Yantella interaction. But in this Z direction, one may have to invoke things like octahedral tilting as one of the mechanisms. It's conceivable that one can explain it in other ways by taking anharmonic terms or whatever. But this is one way I thought I could explain it. Okay. This one is at 50% doping, and these two are for two-thirds doping. The fact that you have two possibilities shows that there's a controversy. This one is what is called as a Wigner crystal phase, and this one is the bistripe phase. And this is the 50% doped CE phase. The CE phase is where you have, the white ones correspond to spins of one orientation and the black dots correspond to spins of the opposite orientation. So in one plane for the C phase, you have two white dots and two black dots, whereas for the E phase, you have three black dots, one white dot, or vice versa, three white dots and one black dot. So the E phase is represented by this black square or rhombus, and the white square is represents the C phase. So you have equal number of C and E, so that's why this is called CE. You have two whites and one black, so this is C2E, whereas here you have two blacks and one white, and so this is CE2. So that's what they are. So at least to my knowledge, the controversy between these two things has not been resolved. One needs a good effective Hamiltonian and to understand this. Okay. So I'll give you a brief overview of our work. Today I'm going to talk mainly about this one that I put on the archive, and I'll compare it with earlier work that I did with my students. So earlier on we have done our philosophy was that before one understands the more complicated two-orbital Jahn-Teller interaction, we thought that we should first understand how to model the Holstein model, which is perhaps one of the simplest models. So the many polaron aspects of the Holstein model itself is fairly complicated, and we thought that we should sort of develop a controlled analytic treatment of the many polaron interaction of the Holstein model. So today I'll talk about introducing cooperative electron phonon effects in what you can call as a Holstein model, and compare it with when you do not have cooperative effects, and see how the cooperative nature of the interaction produces a different type of long-range order. The main result is that when you introduce a cooperative electron-phonon interaction, the dominant hopping changes from the usual nearest neighbor hopping to the next to nearest neighbor hopping. And one ends up getting a strong electron-phonon interaction, a conducting commensurate CDW, which is independent of density. So this is different from the usual pyrrhus CDW, where you have the wave vector that depends upon the density. The period depends upon the density. So the other interesting point is that, usually when you have commensurate CDW, one has insulating nature, but here we have a conducting commensurate CDW.
Can I ask a question? Uh-huh. So in the weak coupling limit, instabilities will be a kind of Fermi surface nesting driven.
Yeah, I'll talk about that.
It will in general depend on the density.
Here I'm talking about strong coupling. For the weak coupling, the analysis would be different. In fact, interestingly enough, to identify the small parameter to do perturbation theory, it's a bit tricky, as I'll point out. When you want to do for weak coupling, the small parameter becomes one thing, whereas when you want to do strong coupling, the small parameter becomes the inverse of that small parameter. So if X is the small parameter for strong coupling, 1 by X is the small parameter for the weak coupling. I'll talk about that. In fact, I'll also talk about our modification of the pyrrhus instability, if time permits. We published that earlier on this year, and I'll talk about that. So first let me talk about the Holstein model, which is essentially comprised of an electron hopping from one side to the other side, and the electron is coupled to lattice distortions only locally. So the distortion here is independent of the distortion here. at least to first order, at least in the Hamiltonian. So if you have a dz square orbital sitting in this direction, it can move these two oxygens in the vertical direction, and that is only locally. Whereas in our cooperative model, there's a dz square orbital that is in the direction of this cane. So if there's a dz square orbital here, it will move the oxygen outwards. But then this oxygen is shared by these two sites. So if you have a dz square orbital here, that will inhibit occupation of an electron in this dz square orbital. So that is where the cooperative nature comes in, whereas such a thing is not there in this case. While I was talking to George and Mona, they told me of their own work on a related model. I'm sort of trying to learn more about it, and probably Mona will talk about it later on. So the starting Hamiltonian is has a hopping term, which is the usual tight binding type. Then you have a lattice term, which is the usual simple harmonic oscillators at each site representing the phonon modes. And then you have the electron-phonon coupling. For the Holstein model, the phonons, which are represented by this A dagger I plus AI, that's a displacement operator, it couples to the local density. Whereas in our model, the phonon at a site couples to the difference of the density on the neighboring two sites. Oops. Yeah. So here this oxygen couples to the difference in density between these two sites. That's what this term represents. So, most of you know, typically when one is trying to deal with strong coupling, one uses for the Holstein model what is called as a Langkwist-Cerf transformation, which is a mathematical way of treating what Holstein earlier had done. And one has to modify such a Langkwist-Cerf transformation to take into account this kind of electron-phonon interaction. Okay. The ones in the magenta color are the new additions due to our model. If you ignore these, if you modify these things, then you get the Holstein model result. Okay. So we used a modification of the... Can you see, George? I'm seem to blow. Okay. We modify the Langkwist-Cerf transformation where this operator S, which is anti-unitary, has the difference in the two densities. Okay, whereas in the usual Langkwist-Cerf transformation, it's only the local density that is put there. So that's the difference between Holstein model and this. So when does the Langkwist-Cerf transformation, one ends up getting this sum of these two terms, H0 and H1. This term actually cancels with this minus 1. So this term, which contains the electron and phonon operators, this is a complicated operator. I've actually rearranged some of the terms so that the destruction operators come here and the creation operators enter this. The reason for that is when I do perturbation theory with respect to phonons, the destruction operators kill all the kill the vacuum. Okay. So this is a useful way of putting it when you want to do perturbation theory. So in the original Holstein treatment, one did not go beyond this H0. So you had H0, you had the phonons. Then here you have decoupled the electron and the phonon degrees of freedom, and then you average over the phonons. So when you average over the phonons, the band narrows. That's because the wave function, the hopping integral, gets diminished because of the overlap of the wave functions of the simple harmonic oscillators on neighboring sites. So that's why this happens. And for our cooperative case, this exponent is further reduced because if this is the oxygen and if there's a dz square orbital here, this potential is lowered, whereas this potential is raised above the usual, so it's unfavorable for an electron to hop to the neighboring site. So that's why you end up getting e to the power of minus 3 g square, whereas for the Holstein case, you get 2 g square there. Okay. So that's the difference, and also this operator now contains phonons at three different locations, whereas in the Holstein case, it contains phonons only at two locations, that's at J and J plus 1. So that is because when an electron is hopping from, if this is J and this is J plus 1, phonons here, here, and here come into the picture, so you have three phonons that enter the picture, so that's why you have this term. And so what I did was treat this as the unperturbed Hamiltonian and I treated this as a perturbation. And it turns out, interestingly, that you can actually do perturbation theory at least to second order exactly, okay, with respect to this. So that's what I did. And the result is, the algebra is a bit tedious, but at the end of the day, one gets this. And I'll point out ways of simplifying this seemingly complicated expression. Each of these factors F, they can be represented in a general form as like this, which for large values of g squared essentially becomes e to the power of g squared and sum of all these alphas divided by g squared and sum of these alphas. So F3411 is basically e to the power of 4 plus 1 plus 1 g squared, that is e to the power of 6 g squared by 6 g squared. This one is e to the power of 5 g squared by 5 g squared. So you can see that for strong electron phonon coupling, this one is e to the power of 6 g squared by 6 g squared. This is the dominant term. For this term, this is the dominant one, e to the power of 4 g squared by 4 g squared. And these are negligible. Okay. So let me physically explain the origins of these four terms. I mean, these two terms are negligible. They are not present for the Holstein case. They come about because of the cooperative nature. And anyway, since they're negligible, I'll only concentrate discussing these two terms. Okay. The first term, Nj, corresponds to an electron hopping and then hopping from J plus 1 to, rather, J to J plus 1 and then back. So there should be a hole here. So that's why you have 1 minus Nj plus 1. And one ends up getting these two terms. On the other hand, electron can hop from J plus 1 to J also. So it is symmetric. The second term, can everyone see what I'm writing here? Okay. The second term corresponds to an electron hopping from J plus 1 to J minus 1. So this is step 1, this is step 2. On the other hand, you can also have an electron hopping in the first instance from J to J minus 1, and then an electron hopping from J plus 1 to J. So in the earlier work of Fradkin and Hirsch, they missed this second diagram. So they got only 1 minus Nj here. We sort of corrected that in our earlier work. Just thought I would mention that. So we call this, this is usually called as an assisted hopping. And in our case, it turns out that this term will be important. Okay. So I'll if you haven't lost me till this point, I'll try to give you a physical explanation for these two terms.
So that second term is hopping from J plus 1 to J minus 1 with an amplitude of minus or plus depending whether Nj
is occupied
or not.
Right.
And you only have spinless fermions, so they're right. All either singly occupied or not.
Not at all. Right. Yeah. If J is occupied, this is the relevant diagram. If J is not occupied, this is the relevant diagram in the perturbation. Okay. For large values of G squared, the previous expressions, they simplify significantly. And this is what one gets. And one can physically explain these terms without even going through the mathematics. Okay. So the ones in magenta color are the things that I would like you to focus attention on. But before I do that, I forgot to mention one other subtle point. That is, when you have cooperative interaction, you have repulsion between nearest neighbors, and that is reflected in this. Whereas for the Holstein model, this term is not present. I just thought I would mention it, because this sort of a idea should be relevant for orbital occupation, when you have cooperative effects, even in degenerate orbital situation. So this is a thing that one should pay attention to. Okay. So leaving that point aside, the main difference between our cooperative model and the Holstein model is these things that are in magenta color. So let's try to understand the difference between these two cases. When you have cooperative interaction, you expect hopping to the neighboring site to be more restrictive. So that's why you have a higher exponent here as compared to the Holstein model. Then also notice that this term is smaller than, rather larger than this term when g square is large. Okay, that's because you have e to the power of minus g square term. I mean, g square appears in the exponent. So at large values of g square, that's electron-phonon coupling, the next nearest neighbor hopping dominates over the nearest neighbor hopping. Whereas for the Holstein case, that is not the case. This is always less than this at large values of g squared. I've not given you my small parameter analysis. The small parameter for this is T by G omega naught. I'll justify this, but for the time being, please accept this as conditional truth. So if T by G omega is a small parameter, and then I'm dividing by further by G here, so clearly this is smaller than this. So this dominates over this one. Okay. So that's the difference between the cooperative case and the Holstein model case. So basically, I mean, the Holstein case, nearest neighbor hopping is the dominant one, and in our case, the next nearest neighbor hopping is the dominant one. Whereas the nearest neighbor repulsion is strong in both cases. Okay. So this is the nearest neighbor repulsion, and here the nearest neighbor repulsion is embedded in this. Okay. So I'll now attempt to give you a physical explanation for the various terms for the Holstein model. Similar logic holds even for the cooperative case. The important point, as I previously mentioned, was that at strong coupling, for cooperative case, next nearest neighbor hopping dominates, whereas for the Holstein case, nearest neighbor hopping dominates. Okay, the physical explanation is as follows. Our results were derived assuming that the modified bandwidth is much smaller than the frequency and you have the strong coupling case. Okay. When we did our perturbation theory, this was taken into account. This condition was taken into account. I had it on my earlier transparency, which I didn't focus attention to. Yeah, here. This is the condition that we use. Okay. So if you use this condition, then perturbation theory becomes very easy because you don't have to worry about the electronic degrees of freedom in the denominator of the perturbation theory. Okay. So, it becomes very easy. Okay. Now for the physical reasoning. I mean, our results are valid for a more general case, that is, the bandwidth being effective bandwidth being much smaller than the phonon frequency and strong coupling, whereas So far, I've been able to come up with a physical reasoning only for a more restrictive case of the adiabatic hopping and a small polaronic regime. But you can see that these two conditions are a subset of this, because if G square omega naught is much larger than T, then you can see that omega naught is much larger than T e to the power of minus G squared, right? Because if you expand it, you get higher order terms also. Okay. So this implies small polaron condition implies this condition. Rajiv, can you see this? Not really, right?
But it's okay.
Okay. So I'll. Okay. So the small polaron condition automatically implies that omega 0 e to the power of g square is much larger than this, and then g square omega naught is much larger than t, and t much larger than omega naught. These two things imply g square is much greater than 1, right? Because if t is much greater than omega naught and g square omega naught is much greater than t, this has to be true. So the physical explanation that I'm going to give is for a more restrictive regime than where our results actually hold, but that's the best I could come up with so far. Okay. So so the coefficient of this term, an electron interacting with a hole on the neighboring side, it results from adiabatic hopping from J to J plus 1 and back. I mean, physically, it's as simple as this, that if an electron hops from this side to this side and then back adiabatically, this side has no time to distort. Right? So if this side has no time to distort compared to this, so the difference in energy is 2g square omega naught, and when you do perturbation theory, this is the energy in the perturbation. You just divide T square by the polaronic energy, and so that's why one ends up getting this as the coefficient. Then for the next to nearest neighbor hopping, which is assisted, it's a little bit more tricky, but a similar reasoning holds. That is, if an electron hops from J plus 1 to J and then J minus 1, this side doesn't distort because it's adiabatic hopping. Only these two sides are distorted. So the starting and the final point are distorted. And that's like, even when you have nearest neighbor hopping, the starting and end sides are distorted. So that's why you have T to the power of minus 2G squared for the distortion at side J minus 1, J plus 1. And this one is for the side J. This the 2g square omega naught is the energy difference between the energy of this and the starting energy. Okay. So the small parameter analysis is a little bit tricky, but the main point is to realize that hopping back and forth between the two sides is the dominant term. I mean, we know that one has to take into account only connected diagrams in perturbation theory, right? So, and this gives you the dominant term because of the adiabatic nature. So, I mean, if the electron hops in step 1 to J plus 1, in step 2 to back to J, and in step 3 to J plus 1 again, one ends up getting in the denominator of perturbation theory G square omega naught, and the second time it's only omega naught and not G square omega naught. So that's the tricky point. If one takes that into account, one gets this as the dominant kth order term, and this is for the odd k. So you can see that T by G omega naught is a small parameter here, because each term has to be less than omega naught, and so that's So that's what I claimed here, and that's the physical explanation for that. I don't know if I got through with the idea, but it's a little bit tricky. I mean, okay. So there's another interesting point that I thought I would point out, both for the Heisenberg case, I mean, for the Holstein case as well as our cooperative case. By using Wigner-Jordan transformation, which converts fermions to spin language, to spins, you can get an effective spin Hamiltonian, and this is exact up to second order. Okay, it's just that in the Holstein case, the next to nearest neighbor interaction is unimportant, and in our case, this term J1 is unimportant. But it turns out that you cannot solve this by beta ansatz because of this next to nearest neighbor interaction. Okay. For the Holstein case, I mean, if you ignore this, of course, it's the anisotropic Heisenberg model and you can solve it by beta ansatz. Whereas in our case, if you ignore J1, you cannot solve it by beta ansatz because of this next nearest neighbor interaction. And so we that's why we decided to model the system using modified Lanczos. And this is where one of our students, Arnab Das, helped me. He wrote the code for this and so on. So I'm grateful to him. Okay. So now I come to the effective Hamiltonian in our cooperative case, which has this next to nearest neighbor hopping and nearest neighbor repulsion. Strictly speaking, I mean, in our case, because of strong coupling, this term is much larger than this. But we decided to study this. I decided to study this in general because of the novelty of this model. This is a new model, so I thought one should probably study this in its generality. So the interesting thing to note is when this V is much larger than T, and you take even number of sites, that is, let's say, six sites or something like that. Okay. So what happens is if V is very large, only the one sublattice gets occupied. And there's a simple explanation for that. That is, I mean, if you put one electron in this sublattice, in the next sublattice, it excludes two sites, whereas in the same sublattice, it excludes one site only. So the next electron, if you want to put it on this in this system, it prefers to go to this same sublattice, either here or here. So that's why when V is very large, you have only one sublattice being populated. And the other interesting point is that when V is equal to zero, you both sublattices are equally occupied. And not only that, this energy is the same as when you have C dagger J plus 1, C J minus 1. I mean, the usual tight binding model. So both this term and this term give the same kinetic energy when V is zero. It's like two sublattices that are completely unentangled. Okay. I thought it was a cute result. I mean, maybe if you see it, it's probably. I mean, it took me at least a little while to realize it. That's why I thought I would mention it. So I calculated the density-density correlation function, the static structure factor, and also the energy for this system. The interesting thing here is that when the nearest neighbor repulsion strength increases, at a critical value, you get a discontinuous phase transition. I mean, I don't have I don't have a very good explanation why it should be so sharp. When I show you the numerical results, you'll see that it's quite sharp. Okay. So I calculated the structure factor as well as the density-density correlation function. And one can show that for the even number of particles, the structure factor at pi goes to zero for even number of particles. And when only one sublattice is occupied, it's given by this formula. I mean, the mathematics is sort of straightforward. So the important thing is to realize, to notice that you have a discontinuous transition, which is interesting, and I'll show that in the next transparency. I mean, there's been a fair bit of mathematics. I suppose, I mean, in a talk I should have toned down on it, but I mean, since there are some number of experts here, I thought that, you know, I would get some feedback from the experts, so that's why I put in the math. So you can see that the structure factor here, this is calculation done on a 16-site ring, and you have, I consider the case of 8 electrons, that is half filling, and 6 electrons. And you can see that when the interaction strength goes from 2.87 to 2.88, the structure factor jumps significantly. It goes from close to 0 to close to its maximum value, that is 16. Both for 8 electrons as well as for 6 electrons. For 6 electrons, when I go from 3.38 to 3.4, it jumps from this to this value. Okay. So at least from our numerical, within the accuracy of our numerics, it appears to be first order of transition, a discontinuous transition. I've done it on smaller system size also. If you go to larger system size, it takes a lot of time, and I didn't think it was worth it. Even for, I've done it for 12 sites and 14 sites and 18 sites. It works out the same. And the other interesting thing is the density-density correlation function for L odd is always constant after the phase transition. So you can see that both here as well as here. For L odd, it's always constant. That's because if one sublattice is occupied, the other sublattice doesn't have any electrons. So it's a direct reflection of that. Okay. And here also, I mean, the same code applies for these triangles and circles and so on. So you can see that it changes drastically when I go from 2.87 to 2.88. The squares and the crosses, they're quite, I mean, the structure factor, I mean, the density-density correlation function is quite different when I change V by a small amount. And I calculated the energy also. For even number of rings, the energy has a kink at the critical interaction strength. So this is what one gets. And when you have odd number of sites, the question of a sublattice doesn't arise. Okay. You have next to nearest neighbor hopping, and you have odd number of sites. So it's like a Mobius strip. Okay. So, I mean, like, let's say that you have 3 sites. So if you have next nearest neighbor hopping, you go from here to here, then you go from here to here. So all the sites are covered. So that's like a Mobius strip. And so there's no 2 sublattices, and the energy increases smoothly. There's no kink here. And so there's a difference between odd and even number of sites. This is our earlier work that I did with my student Sanjay Datta. This is for the Holstein model. So in this case, one could we could get the the phase diagram for different values of electron phonon coupling. And our phase diagram is valid only above this dotted line, which I marked with squares. So So there's a Latinger liquid to CDW transition that one obtains, and these results are consistent with the numerical results of people like McKenzie and Hammer, who have sort of set a benchmark, did a benchmark calculation using BMR gene. For some reason, Monte Carlo doesn't seem to work too well for the Holstein model. I mean, these people had to use a different technique. Later on, Feske did exact diagonalization also. So all this is at half filling. The interesting thing to note is that at strong coupling, Heisenberg anisotropic Heisenberg model, away from half filling, it's always a Latinger liquid. That's a powerful result Haldane came up with some time ago. So that's what we try to capture here. At half filling, you have a sharp peak for the structure factor in the Holstein model, and away from half filling, the peak is broadened, so you don't really have a phase transition here. And for these parameters, you're deep inside the CDW regime for half filling, and in this case, you are at the boundary, so that's why the peak is not as pronounced as in this case. But in the thermodynamic limit, you expect this peak to go to infinity, even this one. I mean, this would go more slowly than this one, but still it would go to infinity. So for the Holstein model, away from half filling, one doesn't, at strong coupling, one doesn't get a CDW state. It's always a Latinger liquid. I'll come to your question soon about the Pyrrhus transition. Okay. So, do I have time to talk about the Pyrrhus instability?
Yeah,
briefly.
Yeah. Okay.
The analysis for the Pyrrhus instability, I won't go through the details of this work because we had to do perturbation theory from a completely different point of view. I mean, the usual degenerate perturbation theory and other types of these things don't work here. So we had to devise a new type of perturbation theory for this. So I'll only tell you the final results for this. The main point that we made in this paper, that Sanjay and I made in this paper, is that the usual static susceptibility is not the relevant one to understand the Pyrrhus instability. One should use the dynamic susceptibility, and one should take the real value of it. So previously, people were using, in place of this omega naught zero, and I mean, everyone knew that it's not the right result because it gives you Pyrrhus instability at vanishingly small electron-phonon coupling, whereas numerical results don't support it. I mean, exact diagonalization and other results, they clearly show that G by T omega naught, the phase transition, this is Latinger liquid, this is CDW. So only at a critical coupling do you get a CDW state. So for, in the adiabatic regime where the spiral instability transition is valid, in this is, let's say, 1. So in this regime where spiral instability would be relevant, I mean, a weak electron phonon coupling does not give you the phase transition. This is a result that's confirmed by different ways of numerics, by exact diagonalization, then DMRG, and maybe there are other things also. So we try to get an analytic way of dealing with it. And so we calculated a renormalized phonon frequency within this approach, where one calculates the double derivative of an operator like the displacement operator. And when you take the expectation value with respect to two different states, and you calculate the energy difference squared. If this energy difference squared turns out to be less than or equal to zero, you get an Pyrrhus instability. So the previous expression that I showed you can be re-expressed in this form. And the reason why I put it in this form is because it agrees with the renormalization group of Caron and Burnaby. Okay. It's exactly that, except that in their result, because it's an RG result, there are some constants which are of the order 1. If you take in their expression C equal to 4 and not 1, you get the same result as we did. Okay. So that gave us some confidence in our result. And this is the numerics of that. So the diamonds are the DMRG results. RG is that of Caron and Burnaby. And this is our work. So you can see that RG and our work match exactly in the adiabatic regime. And they compare fairly well with the DMRG results. And we've also done the Pyrrhus instability condition for away from half filling. This is half filling, that is this. These results are valid only for the adiabatic regime, because you need G omega naught by T to be a small parameter. Okay. So this is a small parameter. It's the inverse of the small parameter when you use Langfield's transformation. So at least, I mean, identifying the small parameter itself was a bit of a task for us. And so finally I'll come to the phase diagram. This phase diagram is only for the Holstein model, okay, not for a cooperative model. Wherever we mention something like Latinger liquid or CDW, we are sure that you get these. But in between, we are not sure when the CDW goes to Latinger liquid. Okay, so to some extent, you should treat this as a qualitative result. So on the y-axis, you have this is the Polaron size parameter, and this is the adiabaticity parameter. So this is the Pyrrhus instability condition that we plotted here. This is away from half-filling. And the CDW could extend even beyond this, but our perturbation theory breaks down here. So that's why we are not sure when CDW goes to this Latinger liquid. But the other interesting thing is away from half-filling, on the anti-adiabatic side, you always, extreme anti-adiabatic side, you always have a Latinger liquid, which was surprising to us. And the other thing was that if G square is very large also, you still have a Latinger liquid in the Holstein model. So I talked to Chris Hammer about it, and he said that he would like to numerically verify it and so on. So I hope he comes up with some, he's got a good group for doing numerics, and suppose your group also is the other competitor. So it would be nice if someone were to verify at least some parts of this phase diagram. I thought it would be a good, it would give hopefully some direction to experimentation also, because usually most of the work that is done in the Holstein model is done in the half-filling case. So we thought we would give at least a qualitative phase diagram for away from half-filling, and this is that. Okay, and so I'll briefly summarize. So as I mentioned, the cooperative interaction leads to a non-local distortion which changes the very nature of long-range order. Then when you have a cooperative strong electron-phonon interaction, the dominant hopping goes from nearest neighbor to next nearest neighbor. And the strong interaction gives a conducting commensurate CDW, which is independent of density, and this is different from the Pyrrhus instability case. And away from half-filling in E-rings, that is, rings with even number of sites, Holstein model gives a Latinger liquid at all interactions, whereas our model at strong interactions gives a CDW state. So, thank you for your attention.
Questions or comments? Anybody?
This cooperative case. Mm-hmm. So you said there is kind of first of the strong first of the transition from the latitude of the liquid to the charged wave state. Mm-hmm. So do you expect that this is for large number of electrons? So if you go to the dilute limit, you will get the second order transition.
That's a good point. At least in our the small systems that I've chosen, like I've done it for system size of 12 and 16 sites. So there, I mean, for two electrons also, there's a phase transition, and it's not as sharp as in the half-filled case, but still it seems to be fairly drastic. So, I mean, one has to, basically the question that you're asking is if number of sites increases to infinity and you have just two electrons, right?
Yeah,
will you have a
dilute, I mean, because the reason why I'm asking, because in that limit is correlated Hopping term becomes a simple next nearest Hopping term, right?
Mm-hmm.
When
mm-hmm.
NGs are basically zero,
uh-huh.
and then it's known for the Hubbard model that the transition will be a second order transition
mm-hmm.
for the charge density.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
So there should be some kind of the critical density where this correlated nature of the Hopping starts to be important and become interaction like rather than Hopping.
So in the Hubbard model, what is the this thing? I mean, the you have next nearest neighbor Hopping again? I mean,
Nj is zero. If the n 1 minus Nj is zero.
Right.
The Nj is zero. Right.
Right.
Then you have just that. Right?
Yeah,
this?
Yeah.
And then? U, N, I?
Yeah.
You have nearest neighbor repulsion or you have...
Nearest neighbor because it's a spinless fermion.
Spinless fermion, right. Okay. I see. For this case, you're saying that it's a second order... it's like an accident, I mean... okay. Mm-hmm. Whose work are you talking about? Whose work are you talking about?
There are many people who did this,
I see. So for this, it's a second order transition at low densities, you're saying, or for a general density?
No, not for that model will become the equivalent to this model at low density.
Right.
So in this model, there is no kind of, say, nobody is in the first order charge density wave transition.
Okay.
So therefore, I'm saying that probably at low density, this first order transition, either will disappear or will become.
Yeah, that's possible. I mean, I'm not very sure. The transition becomes weaker and weaker. There's no doubt about it. That is true. But whether, at what point it goes from first order to second order, if at all it goes second order, that I'm not fully sure. Because within the level of numerics that I've done, it wasn't clear to me. I mean, I could go only till 16 sites and that sort of a thing. Okay. Yeah, that's a good point. Okay. The interaction strength decreases with the interaction strength increases with the number of particles. It goes like this. So at half filling, if the interaction strength is this, then at as the number of particles decreases, the interaction strength increases. Okay. So for up to 16 sites and two electrons, it was V was about 4 for two electrons, and for eight electrons, it was about 2.8 or something like that. Okay. But I mean, in the thermodynamic limit, I'm not sure. I've done a finite size scaling for half filling, but to do finite size scaling away from half filling is a bit tricky, right? You have to take bigger and bigger system sizes. So I've done it only at half filling. And so, the value, you can do finite size scaling Vn minus V infinity goes like 1 by n squared, some constant times n squared. So you can figure that out. Yeah, but I don't have an answer for, in the thermodynamic limit, what happens when you have very few electrons.
But for the case of two electrons within that transformed Hamiltonian, uh-huh. you can solve the thing exactly, right?
Two particle
Green's motion can be solved exactly. So
okay.
You should be able to write down an exact expression for the two particle case independent of the size.
Okay. That's a good point. I have not done it, but yeah. Okay. Yeah, that's the. Mm-hmm. That would give you in
it
the.
Might be interesting.
Yeah, yeah, sure.
Okay. Any other questions? What about the relation with your starting point?
Oh, Jan Taylor. Yeah.
So you did two orbitals, I guess.
I've done that for two orbitals, but I've not written it up because I'm trying to be sure of my results. I mean, when you take the Jahn-Teller interaction, as you know, devising the Lang-Kreutzer transformation for the Jahn-Teller interaction is a bit tricky.
Yeah.
So in one dimension, I've done it, but up till 1/4 filling, one gets the same type of structure. Okay. I mean, the system that I considered was the following, but I'm not. Although I've done the numerics, I'm not sure of the of my numerics fully, so that's why I did not present it. What one does here is that you have oxygen here. So this is the octahedra, and then you have another this thing and so on. Okay. So for this one-dimensional chain, I could figure out what the effective Hamiltonian was, and up till at low density, the same kind of physics holds. I mean, the phase transition, everything is similar. Okay, but at higher densities, I got some result which I'm not that comfortable with. So I'm sort of it's not as pretty as I expected. So that's why I'm holding back on it. You know, usually you would like, you know, beautiful results to come out, and sometimes if things are not as, then you want to rethink.
Okay, well, thank you very much.
Thank you.